So the content of today's panel is we're going to talk about what it means both for in journalism and in activism to go undercover and take on an assumed identity to investigate or challenge or poke fun at, you know, the nasty or sometimes criminal behavior of big powerful interests, you know, multinational companies, government bureaucracies, unscrupulous lobbyists, which Ken has a lot of experience in. And there's one reason that I think it's the conversation is also very timely. I don't know if anybody saw on page one today in the New York Times, there was an article about how Acorn is probably this weekend will announce that it's going bankrupt. This is after half of its chapters closed down across the country. And I cite that because if an investigative journalist and an activist, if their goal through their work is to impact policy or to change an organization or to, you know, potentially disband an organization, then the sort of self-styled investigative journalist that went after Acorn, this James O'Keefe and his entourage, they fulfilled their goal. They destroyed this organization that, you know, with all its foibles, helps, you know, poor folks and working Americans stay in their homes during one of the, you know, the biggest foreclosure crises is happening in the country. And so I think that's an interesting topic that I hope we get to in our conversation today about, you know, is it, you know, obviously we're using this sort of undercover work on the left, but what does it mean when a newly energized right takes up the mantle and says, awesome, we're going to do this too, despite the fact that there was a lot of, I mean, there's all these kind of new revelations coming out now about how the videos of the pimp were deceptively edited and all that, which I think we'll get into. So, the format is, I'm going to be the moderator. My name is Joseph Huffhannon. I'm an independent journalist and continue to jeopardize my career as a serious journalist by working closely with the Yes Men on the release of their latest film and on launching a new Yes Men project, which I think Andy will probably talk about a bit, sort of a new direction for the Yes Men. And enough about me. I'm going to introduce our panelists, and then they're going to kind of just talk about what they do, you know, sort of spill the beans a little bit. And then we're going to have a bit of a freewheeling conversation and have plenty of time for questions because we want lots of questions. I think a lot of this is really we just want to make as transparent as possible this kind of work so that anybody who wants to can do it or, you know, if they think it's scary or weird or, you know, dangerous to find out that it's, you know, it's not necessarily that scary or dangerous and it's a lot of fun. All right. So this is Ken Silverstein. He's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. And he writes the Washington Babylon blog for the Harper's website. And Ken has been in journalism for almost two decades. He was the founder of Counterpunch with Alexander Coburn. He's worked as a staff reporter for the AP, the LA Times. He's written for Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, and of course Harper's Magazine. And he's covered topics like the CIA collaboration with nasty regimes around the world, political corruption in Washington, and collusion between American oil companies and repressive governments across the world. And one of his stories about the behavior of sort of a clique of major U.S. oil companies in Equatorial Guinea, it led to a federal grand jury investigation, an SEC investigation, and, you know, sort of unraveling of a lot of that behavior. But one of the reasons that we invited him up here and got him to come up from D.C. is that he's also the author of many books, but including most recently a book called Turkmenistan: How Washington Lobbyists Fought to Flak for a Stalinist Dictatorship, published in 2008. And that book grew out of a piece that Ken published in Harper's, and it kind of follows him as he took on the identity of a liaison for the government of Turkmenistan, and he went on a kind of a shopping spree in Washington and visited some of the, you know, the biggest, most blue-chip lobbying outfits on K Street to find a buyer to help Turkmenistan burnish its image because it had a nasty reputation of extrajudicial assassinations, locking up human rights activists, all that stuff. And in pretty hilarious detail and really hard-hitting reporting, he basically showed how these lobbying firms just fell on top of each other to take the job. They wanted You know, they kind of put together all these very impressive proposals about how they were going to improve Turkmenistan's PR. And his, you know, the book, it not only drew attention to the, you know, the sort of lack of any moral compass on K Street and the lobbying world, but it also, it drew a lot of kind of, there was a bit of controversy from his colleagues in journalism who said, oh, that's not fair. You went and you interviewed people under an assumed identity. That's not ethical. That's not real journalism. So I hope that Ken talks a little bit about that and sort of defends, you know, or talks about what he, you know, why he thinks it is a good thing to do that in journalism. And last but not least, his most recent dispatch was in the January issue of Harper's, and Ken traveled to Cambodia as an American businessman, and he basically, after Cambodia had signed a trade deal with the U.S. to try to clean up its garment industry, pay its workers living wages, he basically went shopping for the best sweatshop. And it's what he found was not very encouraging, to say the least. So, now let me do a quick intro for Yes Man Andy, and then I'm going to let Ken. Or should I intro Andy before you talk? What do you think?
Yeah.
Why don't we let... We're going to pass it over to Ken, and then I'm going to talk a bit about Andy.
Okay, so how do I turn this thing on? You can hear me. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm going to talk hopefully for about 20 minutes or so. I am teaching a class this semester in Washington, and I am always petrified that I'm going to end the class 30 minutes early or be right in the middle of the most important point when my time is up. So I will try to keep it to 20 or 25 minutes. And I hope there'll be lots of time for questions afterwards, after Andy talks. So I've been working as a journalist for actually more than 20 years, and I have only employed undercover reporting a few times. I think it can be abused, but certainly it's a legitimate tactic, generally out of favor in the American media, which I don't quite understand, but you know, you don't want to do it too often, but you can make good use of it, in my view. Most papers in the United States ban undercover reporting now. The New York Times, I'm pretty sure, doesn't allow it at all. The Washington Post, I know, does not allow it. Most papers will not allow it. The networks will still do it, although frequently their undercover reporting is stuff like To Catch a Predator. It's not really aimed at, you know, I mean, I'm not defending predators here, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if you're going to use undercover reporting, I think the target should be powerful institutions and people, and it's just, I mean, it's, you know, as opposed to sensationalism, which is what ABC does with that show. NPR will still allow it periodically, although under very, very restrictive rules. But it's pretty much been outlawed in America, or very much frowned upon. And, you know, journalists, I'll talk a little bit later about the ethics, but sometimes it's presented as, oh, it's just, you know, it's unethical, it's just wrong to do it. Well, there are a couple of reasons, actually, why journalists don't do undercover reporting anymore. And it's not all because it's concerned about ethics. One of the reasons, I worked at the LA Times in the Washington Bureau for a number of years on the investigative unit, and I can tell you that for most of January, people think nothing but who's going to win the Pulitzer Prize and a variety of other journalism prizes. And you really cannot win prizes anymore doing undercover reporting because it's so frowned upon now. Back in the 80s, Chicago Sun-Times did an amazing undercover series where they actually bought a tavern called The Mirage, and the reporters worked as bartenders and waitresses, and they found, like the fire inspector for $10 agreed not to inspect the premises, and they found all sorts of crazy abuses. Everybody said they were going to win the Pulitzer Prize. They didn't, because Ben Bradley, the Washington Post editor of Watergate fame, and another very prominent editor were on the Pulitzer panel. This is a little bit apocryphal, this story, but it's solid enough that I'm confident that this is actually what happened. Bradley and another editor decided that Sun-Times should not get the prize. They didn't. It was awarded to somebody else. And it hugely discouraged undercover reporting, because newspapers said, oh, God, we're going to get a bad name. We're not going to win a Pulitzer. You know, so why are we going to invest all this time and money if we're not going to win prizes? And I can tell you, prizes are hugely important to journalists. Don't ask me why. anyway, everybody has rules for undercover reporting. You know, I do think you shouldn't just, okay, this would be fun to do. Let's just go do it. I mean, there should be some rules on when you use it. Rule number one for me is if my editor says, yes, you can do it. I mean, obviously, you know, you That's step one. The other issues for me, and some people or institutions will have 8 or 10 rules. To me, it's not that complicated. There has to be some sort of legitimate public interest. You have to get information that you normally wouldn't be able to get any other way, and you have to disclose the deception to the reader so that the reader or viewer knows that you have, in fact, let's just use the real word instead of trying some way, nice word, you lie. You do use lies and deceptions to do undercover reporting, and you have to acknowledge that up front and let the reader decide whether they're comfortable with that. So I have really only done it 4 or 5 times. Joseph talked about the Cambodia story. I went to the Bahamas once and posed as a rich American. I wanted to demonstrate how easy it is to open an offshore account to hide away money that might be drug money or corrupt money, or whether it's just, I don't want my partner who I'm about to divorce to know that I have lots of money. But, the offshore banking is a huge, it's trillions and trillions of dollars. It's an enormous issue. So I went to the Bahamas, got off of a plane, and a couple of hours later had opened an offshore account. There was no money in it, but I went through the motions. So that to me was an important story. When I worked for The Nation magazine, I made a contribution. I posed as a representative of a broadcasting firm based in Florida, and I made contributions to a couple of members of Congress and attended their fundraisers in the guise that I was looking for access to members of Congress, and also contacted the National Republican Party and the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee and suggested that my company was very interested in making big, big donations. And this will give you an idea of how long ago it was. The fax machine was still commonly used. But I gave them the phony phone number for my political action committee affiliated with the company, and I started getting these faxes from the Democrats and Republicans saying, well, for $25,000, you can come on our ski retreat and meet 6 senators, but if you give $100,000, you can meet 10 senators at our Boca Raton week-long retreat. So, that to me offered a unique world into, a unique view into that whole world, that corrupt world of campaign money. And then the Turkmenistan story, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. Before talking about the Turkmenistan story, though, I have to say journalists get very, very moralistic about, deception and honesty, and, you can never deceive people in journalism, which is ridiculous. Anyone who tells you, if you're a journalist and you're not deceiving people, then you're not really doing your job. You're presumably working on press releases. And I can tell you what I mean. Do you ever call up a target of an investigation and tell them, I think you're really a scumbag and I'm going to do a huge investigation to destroy you? Would you get the interview? Of course not. Every time you call a source, you're spinning that source. You're constantly deceiving the people you're calling. There's no other way around it. I can give you a few more specific examples. Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post, a media critic at the Post, who really attacked my piece on Turkmenistan, thank goodness, because he probably sold an additional 30,000 copies on the newsstand as a result of his story in the Washington Post. He called me to talk about the piece, and I started offering a defense of undercover, and he said to me, it's okay. I haven't really made up my mind yet. And then somehow the next day, he wrote a piece saying that undercover reporting was always wrong. You could never deceive your sources. In no circumstance was undercover reporting legitimate. So apparently, after talking to me, he made this great conclusion that undercover reporting was unethical. Please. Of course, he knew exactly what he was going to write going in. And how stupid am I? I knew what he was going to write, but I spoke to him anyway, as I would talk to anyone who called for an interview. And lastly, I will give you an example. I recently did a piece for Harper's the New York Times did as well, where the son of the dictator of Equatorial Guinea, which is one of the most corrupt countries in the world, has a $35 million mansion in Malibu, and he funneled $100 million into the United States. And I had Justice Department documents and Immigration and Customs Service documents detailing the investigation against the son of the dictator, who actually is a government minister as well. He's technically called the Minister of the Environment, which is popularly known as the Minister of Chopping Down Trees, because that's what he does, and then he takes the money from the international timber companies and puts it into his own accounts, which is how he funneled $100 million into the United States over a period of 18 months. Anyway, so Technically, corrupt foreign officials are not allowed to enter the United States under an executive order issued by President Bush and has been kept in place by President Obama. But of course, if you are from an oil-rich firm friendly to the United States, you can get into the country without any problem. But the point of my piece, beyond exposing the corruption, was to show this flimsiness of this list. And I suddenly realized at one point that though I knew he had an estate in Malibu, I didn't actually know how often or if he was even traveling to the United States. So I wanted to say, well, this list is a joke. You know, he's coming and going, but, you know, how is it that he's so notoriously corrupt and he can come into the country? Well, I had to prove he was coming into the country, which is, I didn't know. So what I did was to call the lobbyist for the government of Equatorial Guinea and say, I'm going to press soon with a story that says that your client is banned from entering the United States under the, you know, he can't get into the country, he's on the list of banned officials, which is complete garbage. I mean, I knew he wasn't on the list, but I had to prove he was getting into the country. So the lobbyist said, absolutely false. He was just in the country a month ago. He was in Houston at a conference. I was like, thank you very much, that's all I need. Talk to you soon. So, I mean, you know, there was no... You deceive people all the time. If you're not deceiving, as I said up top, if you're not deceiving people, well, you know, find another way of earning a living. And I mean, I'm not saying that you just always lie to people, but this is a part of journalism. And everyone at every major newspaper who's doing investigative work or any long form work is doing that routinely. You have to deceive people. Undercover reporting, of course, is different. It's more flat out deceptive. But there are shades of gray, is my point. The Turkmenistan story. How long have I
been? Oh, you're good. Yeah.
Okay, just give me the hook and what, because I actually lost. I don't know when I started, so I can't keep track of time. Turkmenistan story. I started working on this piece in 2006, and the point was that I wanted to show that despite all of the talk in Washington about how, you know, bad lobbying was and how Washington, you know, the Congress had cleaned up after Abramoff, that in fact nothing had really changed and that lobbying was as corrupt as ever and as lucrative as ever and that lobbyists were as busy as ever. So the original idea actually was to create a phony defense contractor and to approach a member of Congress, and I have to say that target one would have been the recently deceased John Murtha of Pennsylvania, who, you know, was constantly, I mean, he was a very powerful member, the most powerful member of the subcommittee, National Defense Subcommittee in the House, and was notorious for earmarking funds to his campaign donors and well-connected lobbyists. And I actually talked to a lobbyist, a defense lobbyist, and asked, you know, how can I set this thing up? And he said to me, oh, you're overthinking it. It's really, really quite simple. I mean, if you hire the right lobbyist, you create your phony firm, and then you hire the right lobbyist, you'll get the money. He said, it doesn't matter what you ask for. You can say that your plan is to outfit a flock of pigeons with cell phones. You'll get the $2 million earmark if you get the right lobbyist. So that was the original plan, which unfortunately we couldn't do because it would have cost probably, you know, $6,000 a month for 6 months minimum to hire a lobbying firm to get the earmark, and the expenses were way too high. So we decided to go to, let's look and see what lobbying firm in Washington will represent the lowest foreign client. We won't actually hire them, but we'll see if we can get them to agree to represent a really creepy, awful foreign dictatorship. So we originally considered North Korea and Iraqi insurgents, but we realized that this was probably over the top. So we picked the next best thing, which was Turkmenistan. Which I don't know how many of you are familiar with Turkmenistan. It doesn't get a lot of press. When it does, it's terrible press because it's just a horrible place. When I started looking into this story, the long-standing dictator who had ruled the country under the Soviet, when there was still a Soviet Union and kept power afterwards and had declared himself president for life and named himself the Great Turkmenbashi, he, you know, renamed the months of the calendar after himself and his mother and relatives, and you know, to get a driver's license you had to like spend 16 hours studying the works of the Turkmenbashi. He erected monuments all over the country, the most famous one in downtown Ashgabat, the capital, which I have sadly been to, And it's a golden statue that rotates, so the Turkmenbashi's face always is facing the sun. It's a nutty, horrible dictatorship. There's a humorous element to it, but it's an awful, awful place. So he had recently died, and making the story even more delicious, he'd been replaced by his personal dentist as president. And so it's like, okay, it can't get worse than this. Let's see if lobbyists will go to work for them. So I created a company called the Malden Group, which was named after a British brand of table salt. And we picked a phony office in London. We found a business address on the web. And the cover story was ridiculously flimsy. I mean, I had a business card made on a printer at Harper's Magazine, which looked, you know, totally flimsy. We created a website which was just a home page with the phony address and the phone number for the Malden Group in London, which was the phone number that I carried. I bought a British cell phone so that people... I would be at my home office in Washington, but the lobbyists could call me in London on a British number, so I would, you know, be sitting there in my Washington office talking from London. I was always petrified that, you know, the distinctive sound of an American ambulance would come by as opposed to, you know, and that I was going to be busted or a police car came cruising by. But anyway, so I started calling up these lobbyists and, you know, telling them about how I wanted them to work for Turkmenistan, that my company had a stake in the energy fields of Turkmenistan, and we wanted to enhance our own position by hiring a lobbyist to work for the government and to improve its image and improve its relationship with the United States government. This is, incidentally, a common occurrence. This is frequently the way lobbyists are hired. And the other thing I did was to create the most ridiculous firm. I mean, the Malden Group, if you spend 5 minutes on Google, you will know that any energy firm in Turkmenistan is basically a mobbed-up firm. I mean, the energy firms there, you know, exist to funnel money into offshore accounts on behalf of Turkmen government officials. And you spend 5 minutes online and you know. It's you know, so I created, not only was it this, you know, horrible dictatorship, but the firm I was working for was clearly suspect and mobbed up. And I also said, and by the way, discretion is the very lifeblood of our operation there, and we can't possibly have you disclosing anything about it, so you'll have to sign a confidentiality agreement, and you won't be able to talk about any of this. So the whole thing was completely suspect. You know, I don't think you should entrap people doing investigative journalism, and this was definitely not entrapment. I did not call them. I made a routine call, a call that happens every day in Washington, and you know, I tried to base it as much as possible on the real way that lobbying works. And, you know, I did not place... It was not like I put a sack of money in front of a Boy Scout and watched him steal it and then said, oh, you bad boy. I mean, I set up a situation that was very realistic, but made it pretty much over the top, and where there were a million red flags and where the lobbyists should have said, there's something really bad about this, we won't do it. But, of course, they didn't. So in any case, I went in and I met with the lobbyist, and I'm just going to, afterwards, they both, well, Cassidy and Associates, which is one of the, both of them, I called four firms. The two I actually met, they all agreed to meet with me, but a couple of the firms asked me, you know, questions that I deemed as offensive, like, who's your boss? Who do you work for? And I just, so I can't tell you, and, you know, none of your business. If you don't like it, I can meet with other firms. So I met with the two firms who did zero due diligence, Cassidy and Associates and APCO. And after I came, if anybody wants to talk more about it during the question and answer, I can answer any questions. But quickly, afterwards, Cassidy sent me a 12-page proposal on how they would whitewash the regime in Turkmenistan. And I'll just read you a few quotes from it. They called me Dear Mr. Case, because my name was Kenneth Case. I actually came up with the name Kenneth Case because I'm a big fan of Nico Case, and I was listening to a song by her, and I decided that it would be nice to be married to Nico Case, so I'll just take her last name. So anyway, Dear Mr. Case, you know, what a pleasure it was to meet you, blah, blah, blah. We're confident that we can help you achieve your goal of advancing economic, political, and energy cooperation between the U.S. and Turkmenistan. Our bipartisan staff is comprised of former members of the U.S. Congress, senior congressional aides, high-level administration and agency officials, senior and flag-ranked military officers and business executives, all of whom possess outstanding first-hand knowledge of federal government operations and decision-making at all levels. They said, our engagement will involve reaching out to federal officials, academics, business executives, journalists, and other opinion leaders whose thoughts, words, and actions help dictate U.S. policy as it pertains to Turkmenistan. Our goal will be to advance bilateral agenda items in a manner that helps to enhance the Mullen Group's business agendas. They went on to say that we will be your eyes and ears in Washington. We will recommend initiatives and execute them. We will help you be an even more effective and attractive strategic partner for your colleagues in Turkmenistan. By the way, one of the things that happened during the meeting with Cassidy, which was really very strange, was that this firm, some of the lobbyists at the firm said that they had previous dealings with the government of Turkmenistan, and they had many years earlier, 5 or 6 or 7 years earlier anyway, known a number of government officials and ministers. But unfortunately, the lobbyist who was telling this, he said, but unfortunately, ministers there tend to get shuffled off. And the whole room erupted in laughter. There were like 10 lobbyists sitting around the table, and it was like, oh, wow, that's really hysterical, because shuffled off is just code for, you know, sent to jail or disappear. You know, it was very strange, actually, because their laughter, I think, was a sign of their nervousness and their actual recognition that what they were doing was wrong. It broke the tension, but everyone was aware of what the guy was saying, but you couldn't actually acknowledge, oh, we're trying to compete for a really horrible contract, and we have to look ourselves in the mirror. So, I mean, it was an interesting moment where it's like, oh, you do know what you're doing is wrong. Anyway, they talked about a lot of the pitches I got from these people were in code. They said that that they'd done some preliminary investigations, and they had discovered that the U.S. government was very much interested in improving relations with Turkmenistan because of all the natural gas and energy over there. But they said, we've become aware of U.S. determination to aggressively push an agenda of human rights and democratic reforms in exchange for greater engagement with Ashgabat, the capital of Turkmenistan, which I'm sure this is total garbage. I'm sure they were sitting there going, okay, we've got to let these people know it's going to cost a lot of money to do what they want done, that it's a tricky assignment. And this was sort of paving the way for what they wanted to charge me. And you will find in Washington that the more difficult the client, the more that the firms charge. Anyway, I love this too. This is all coded beautifully. They say, with regard to, they talked about doing crisis communications. They'd say, we could compile a list of potential vulnerabilities, such as humanitarian issues, social conditions, and otherwise, so that we are prepared for a possible crisis arising from one of or more of these vulnerabilities, which is code for if the government manages to shoot down 1,000 people in a public square, we will take charge and spin the situation so it doesn't really affect you too negatively. You know, they say, with these issues in mind, we'll conduct worst-case scenario planning and response development by anticipating crises, preparing spokespeople, and drafting statements, et cetera, et cetera. But this is all really about, okay, we know that things could get ugly in a hurry, and we're prepared to handle it. And then, of course, they close by saying, they told me during the meeting that, you know, this is a tricky assignment. It would have to be, they couldn't accomplish everything I wanted over 1 year. It'd have to be a three-year deal. So they said, our fees are based on the scope of the engagement and the complexity of the assignments. The fee for the activities described above is U.S. $1.32 million plus expenses for a one-year engagement. So effectively, they were proposing a $5 million deal over 3 years. Fees and expenses over 3 years was about $5 million. Do I have any time left?
Yeah.
The other firm I met with was APCO. I wish I had an overhead projector. They gave me this lovely PowerPoint presentation. Here's the cover page with the nice Turkmen flag, a communications program for Turkmenistan and the United States. The team I met with was Ambassador Beth Jones, who was the former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and an assistant secretary of state. During the presentation, they said that she excelled at smiling and dialing, which meant she smiled and called her former colleagues in the State Department, and she could do this on behalf of Turkmenistan. There was a guy named Barry Schumacher, a former Hill staffer, Jennifer Dick, who was the former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney at the time that he managed to shoot the guy in the face, as a matter of fact. So she had real expertise in crisis communications. And Robert Downin, a vice president who worked for Bob Dole at one point. And then they said, we have all these other resources we can bring to the table, and that was, you know, a bunch of former members of Congress, National Security Council officials, CIA officials. They said that that the new elections, because this is the thing, I called them and said, look, you know, the dentist is about to run for office, you know, and this is a great moment for us to hire a lobbying firm. Now, there's no opposition in Turkmenistan. It's constitutionally regarded as treason to oppose the government. So there were five other people running against him, all from the president's political party. I mean, it was a complete sham election. But I said, well, there's an election coming up, you know. Democracy is emerging here. So they say, you know, yes, they say, in fact, elections provide new opportunity to define Turkmenistan. And this is also coded. They say the administration, this was the Bush administration at the time, is realistic about progress. They're not expecting major changes, but they want some modest concrete proposals. So it's like, okay, just give us something we can work with. We're not expecting democracy or anything resembling democracy, but give us a little something we can work with there. But what they, both of the firms said, we're going to focus on energy. Look, the human rights situation, there's only so much we can do. But they've got a lot of energy in their national security issues, and that's what we're going to focus on. And this is also coded. Turkmenistan does have a short window of opportunity to redefine and promote itself, but it must act fast to take advantage of it, meaning you need to hire us as quickly as possible. I mean, that's, you know, this is all like, yeah, if you don't act now, the window will slam shut. So they talked about, you know, reaching out to former to members of Congress. They said this was easily done. They talked about how they would take members of Congress and staffers to Turkmenistan on junkets, which they said actually we're not allowed to do because lobbyists can't pay for this, but what we'll do is we'll contact a Turkmen think tank or university and arrange for them to pay it, and then we can do it. Then it's legal. So they said they would do media monitoring, identify key reporters who could receive news items, and this I loved. They said, he told me they had someone on staff whose job, you know, their 9-to-5 job was to write, find signatories for, and place opinion pieces in key publications. So basically, you have an APCO lobbyist writing opinion pieces, goes out and recruits an academic or a think tank person to put his name or her name on the piece so it looks like an independent piece, and then they go place it in an American newspaper so it looks like an independent voice operating on behalf of, or who thinks Turkmenistan is changing. They told me, you know, we can't, like, turn things around overnight, but basically they said we can create shades of gray. That's, you know, with Turkmenistan, that's good. The best you can do is shades of gray because you have black and white. And the other thing, and then I'll close, I'm sorry if I've rambled on too long, is that they said that they would hold events with U.S. think tanks in the United States, which would appear to be independent events, but that they would make them, they would make them look independent, even though they were basically going to be controlled by the lobbying firm, or generally controlled by the lobbying firm. And one of the members of the APCO team actually said to me, you know, we don't want to be too obvious about it, so we're not going to call it Turkmenistan Day. We'll call it, like, Caspian Sea Pipeline Day, or something like that. And that way it won't be so obvious that this is a sham event for Turkmenistan. It'll look like, you know, something more general. And then their fees, which were, in comparison to Cassidy, I must say quite cheap, were $40,000 a month, and reasonable and normal expenses, which included 10% of fees. And they wanted to create a website for the government of Turkmenistan, which desperately needed one. I mean, the Turkmen website was all about, you know, president talks about cotton production, or, you know, president stands next to big truck. So they wanted to upgrade the Turkmen government website, and then all this other money for these additional events. I have run out of time. I wanted to talk about the media reaction to the piece and the sort of ethics issues surrounding it and all, but I'm afraid I've gone too long.
So why don't we just, we'll go back to that when we sort of enter into discussion mode.
Okay.
But that was hilarious. Okay, that was, yeah, that was extremely hilarious. Does anybody really want to go to Turkmenistan now? Is there, now that there are some new visa opportunities, perhaps? So now it is my pleasure to introduce Andy Bickelbaum, who is the co-founder of the Yes Men. And maybe some of you have seen some of their films, or maybe some of you were in town when a very interesting and, you know, unexpected special edition of maybe the New York Times or the New York Post was passed out to you. But the Yes Men are filmmakers, they're provocateurs, mischief makers, and they've been impersonating, cajoling, otherwise, making life miserable for a number of powerful companies, government bureaucracies, and even in one case, a whole entire country over the years. And Andy and Mike got their start, Mike, who is still on 1995 somewhere, they got their start impersonating the World Trade Organization, making a little fake website for the WTO called GATT. org, and then subsequently getting invited to business conferences all around the world to speak on behalf of the WTO. And they did this for I think, at least a couple of years, made increasingly ever more shocking sort of announcements. And then sort of the denouement was when they were at a business conference in Sydney, Australia, where they solemnly declared the closure of the WTO and the disbanding of it. And it was a conference of business people, but many of them came out and greeted the news with approval and said, yeah, it's about time. This is not such a bad thing. And all of that was documented in a documentary called The Yes Men, which was made by some other great folks, some documentary filmmakers. And then since then, The Yes Men have been lending this very unique approach to rebranding to some of our most esteemed multinational corporations at conferences and in the news media around the world. They've impersonated, or Andy has impersonated Dow Chemical to an audience of 300 million on BBC. They have presented a very weird, is the best way to describe it, a new Halliburton product called the Survival Ball, which we also had 20 Survival Balls running around town all last fall. They sort of made a reappearance around UN Climate Week here in New York. And they've also punked ExxonMobil, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and then the examples I cited earlier, the special edition Iraq War is Over New York Times. Did anybody here receive that? Was anybody walking around and got a copy? Awesome. More recently, the New York Post got a touch of that as well when they released an uncharacteristically climate change conscious edition. That even we had some people on the scene who were there when Rupert Murdoch was handed a copy when he was walking into the News Corp building. And too bad nobody had a camera there, because that would have been hilarious. Last but not least, the Chamber of Commerce has had a taste of Yes Men intervention recently down in Washington. And in the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen, the whole entire, I wouldn't say country, but the government of Canada came in for a bit of a whipping when the Yes Men teamed up with a group of Canadian youth activists to preemptively make a really positive announcement about Canada's new approach to emissions and setting these really ambitious emissions targets, which were, of course, completely false. And I would just, one little note before I'll let Andy go on, is that Andy and Mike have been doing this for almost a decade now, but there's a lot of Yes people everywhere. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of volunteers that make it all work, and there's a whole new effort that I think Andy will probably talk about to breed new Yes people, or not breed, but produce or otherwise encourage. But I think maybe there was a video that perhaps you wanted to do that now or in a second?
Well, I'll
he'll introduce the video.
I'll set it up a little bit.
Yeah. As Ken was talking and earlier we were talking, I kept thinking about the interrelationship between the incredible work that Ken and his colleagues do, investigative reporting, the connections between that and civil disobedience, both essential components of democracy that are not as highlighted as they should be, and the work that we do. And that part's easy. I think we occasionally, in the kind of work that we do, find new little nuggets of information that we're able to share with the world. But mostly what we do is just highlighting things that everybody can easily find out and just trying to bring it to wide attention of people. That's pretty much it. Just finding funny stories, funny tricks, funny ways to bring important issues that are easily knowable to the widest possible attention. And I guess there's a component of that also in investigative reporting where you come up with a lot of new things, but then there's a lot like a lot of new things there that nobody knew, but the fact of lobbying, I think, like, wow, we all kind of know it's gross and that they'll serve anybody, but it really demonstrates that and the whole phenomenon. So anyways, we do sometimes, as I said, find out little snippets of things. We do actually do classic investigative journalism, as it were, occasionally. And we're very, very good at it. And I'd like to show a video. It's an extra on our DVD, parenthetically selling for $20, if you'd like, coming out April 1st. But if you'd like it, you can get it early. It was actually heavily edited. You can't tell because of the way we put it together, but I was actually wearing a big fur thing around me and these dark glasses, and I totally looked like a pimp, which is actually why it didn't work. That, you guys know that story, right? Okay. James O'Keefe, the acorn pimp who actually wasn't dressed as a pimp. Looking at this, I thought, as I was thinking of that reference, I was also thinking of how actually amateurish he was when he went in to bug Mary Landrieu's, Senator Landrieu's office or whatever he was doing in there. He didn't even bring an ID card, kind of like we didn't. So, yeah, it's tough. You have to make them out of plastic. And I prepared some notes, but we could just also.
I mean, I have a couple of things to start off. Yeah. If you, okay. I mean, actually, just wanted to, just because Andy mentioned and we talked a little bit about O'Keefe. Is everybody pretty familiar with that story? Does anybody need a quick recap? Or it's pretty well known, right? The pimp outfit, the Acorn offices. It turns out the videos were totally edited deceptively. He was not dressed as a pimp when he went in and talked to the Acorn workers. He was actually dressed in a nice slacks and button down and said, I'm a law student. I'm really concerned about my girlfriend and her abusive pimp. I bring it up because Andy actually had an interesting run-in with Mr. O'Keefe that I kind of wanted to ask him maybe if he wanted to share that with us.
Yeah, interesting twist. After a screening of our film at Film Forum in October, this kid came up to me and said, do you recognize me? I said, nope, must have met you or slept with you or something, I don't know, but sorry. And he said, just think about it. And I went to talk to some other people, and he just kept looking at me and turned back, and I said, what? And he said, don't you recognize me? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'm the Acorn pimp. And I'm the one who brought down Acorn. And I just wanted to tell you that I'm really inspired by you and that I learned everything I learned from the Yes Men. So actually, you brought down Acorn. How does that make you feel? And I looked around him, and there were these four people standing around him, all facing me very, very carefully, and I'm sure they all had hidden cameras, and they were just waiting for me to slug him or strangle him or something, which of course I felt like doing. But then I just said something reasoned about how absurd it was. If you have powers of investigative journalism, if you have the interest in doing it, to go after people who are helping the powerless, it seems like it should only be used against the powerful. And he said something about fair and balanced, how you have to go after everybody. And so that was an unpleasant night, sorry.
And what do you think, Ken, about, I mean, sort of the, you know, should that kind of, I mean, it's a technique, everybody and anybody should use it. Do you, you know, Andy, you know, kind of thinks that it should only be used to go after the powerful. Do you have any thoughts or critique on that?
Well, I think that, as I said up top, I don't believe you should just, for any story, you should use undercover reporting. I do think there should be some standards. And so, you know, if you can't get the information in another way, that to me is one major issue. But I have to say, until I heard about the bogusness of, from Andy, as a matter of fact, of how they had not actually gone in. I mean, when you look at the videos, it looks like it's this ridiculous pimp outfit, and she's dressed as a prostitute. The whole thing seems so stupid and over the top. I have to say, if you are in favor of if you think undercover reporting is legitimate, you can't say, well, it's illegitimate if somebody from another political point of view uses it. I do think that targets should be selected carefully, and you know, that does matter. I thought Acorn, I thought that it was fine. I mean, Acorn, and I would actually urge anyone who thinks, I know Acorn is generally thought to be a very good progressive organization, but I've heard from a lot of people who I respect that Acorn has been a mess for a long, long time. Is it, you know, a powerful chemical company? No, it's not. But I'm not sure I would rule it out as a target. What's the problem to me with it is that they appeared to be completely dishonest in how they presented what they had done. Acorn certainly wouldn't have been my first pick, personally, but to me the problem was more, you know, I mean, if they fake these images, then that's just completely misleading, and, I mean, that's what caused the whole sensation, so. But in theory, I don't know. You know, the fact is people have different points of view, and so I may think that a corporation, you know, a big corporation is a legitimate target, and other people may think that a group like Acorn is. I don't know. It's hard to just say politically, oh, that's off target. But in this case, the problem is just, you know, they fake the whole thing, yeah. It seems.
But isn't there an argument in the public interest element? You listed 4 criteria for doing it, and it just seems like a stretch to think that bringing down Acorn is somehow going to be in the public interest, even if they're a mess. You know, maybe cleaning them up would be in the public mm-hmm. interest, but, you know, just cutting their funding.
Again, it wouldn't have been my target. I mean, it wouldn't have been on my list of top 300 targets. But it's difficult because even though I may completely disagree politically with the critics of Acorn, or at least, yeah, I mean, with their politics, I don't know, it gets tricky. All I can say is it would not have been a target for me. You know, I would not have gone after Acorn. God knows there are plenty of other places.
My thoughts are, I think it brings up questions of power, too, because, and how the political kind of system responds to, you know, to the thing. I mean, Acorn was sort of financially destroyed because Congress yanked their funds, private donations dried up. I wonder if I'd be curious to know if any of the lobbying groups, after your investigation, like if they lost any business or if maybe they got new business, you know? I mean, that would be kind of interesting to follow up on.
Well, you know, I used to believe a long time ago that I could write a story and change the world, but sadly I've learned that that's rarely happens. I like to believe and do believe that in doing journalism that if you go after the right target that you just have to accept that that's the good in the work. And if you get more out of it and you have a bigger impact, that's great. I've written 2 stories, which I'm very proud of, the work I've done in Equatorial Guinea, which is, you know, I know most people are not familiar with Equatorial Guinea in this country, but, you know, it's sort of like in the League of Turkmenistan. In 1996, the United States cut off or closed its embassy in Equatorial Guinea, partly for budgetary reasons and partly because it was just a horrible place, desperately poor. There was no strategic interest there. I mean, it was one of the poorest places on the planet, and also they had just threatened to kill the American ambassador, who was a really good guy, actually. I mean, a great guy, a really strong critic of the regime. So we cut off relations, and then in one of these embarrassing moments, you know, a few months later, Exxon discovers a lot of oil offshore Equatorial Guinea, and it's like, oops, you know, maybe we were premature in closing the embassy. And so ever since the discovered oil and the $5 billion in money, American oil company money poured in, there's been this slow backtracking under Clinton and then very, very quickly under Bush, and which will be continued by Obama. It's not going to change. In terms of, I mean, there's too much oil. The American government, whether it's Obama or Bush or Clinton or whoever, is going to find a reason not to disrupt that relationship. But you can make life very uncomfortable for them in a lot of ways. I mean, I know that, you know, 2 of the stories I did led to Senate investigations. Riggs Bank disappeared as a result, which laundered money for Pinochet. I mean, my first story in Equatorial Guinea was a piece about how Equatorial Guinea had, the president had control over $500 million worth of oil money deposited at Riggs. So it's like Riggs got hit with the biggest fine in the history of, under the Bank Secrecy Act, ultimately went out of business. Senate investigations. Obiang was hugely embarrassed. So, you know, look, are lobbyists not going to take their money? No. I mean, they'll continue to take money. They'll continue to take these horrible clients, but it makes it a little bit more difficult. And I guess I just have, I have realistic goals at this point. I like to work on stories that are interesting to me and that I think expose bad stuff, and then hope there's an impact, and that's always great. But knowing that, you know, Washington lobbying is not going to be cleaned up because of that story, as much as I would like to believe otherwise.
I guess I was going to ask, let me go back to Andy, and then I'll have a question for you too. Andy, Mike and you and other folks that are part of the Yes Men have kind of talked before about the way they see the Yes Men interventions, investigations as part of sort of in service to or part of, you know, other movements and kind of, you know, other campaign-based organizations. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that, sort of how you envision the work as part of a larger movement?
Mm-hmm. Just as investigative journalism is a crucial component of democracy, as you were saying earlier, and like without it, politicians don't feel their feet kept to the fire, and they need to have that. I think not our work, but civil disobedience, broadly speaking, is another critical component of democracy that should be taught in elementary school textbooks as like one of the, you know, five components to make democracy. And what we've been doing, that has nothing to do with your question, but what we've been doing lately is working more and more closely with large groups who have a strategic plan to affect legislation, to change the way things are done. When I went on the BBC as a representative of Dow Chemical and took full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe, that was in collaboration with Greenpeace, actually, who had a whole Bhopal campaign. And they had actually suggested we set up the site that got the accidental invitation in the first place, and then when we got the invitation, we strategized with them about what the most effective thing to do would be. And since then, we've worked more and more. Some of the examples that Joseph cited, where last year we collaborated with, December, I guess it was, with the Canadian Youth Delegation, not supposed to say that, with a Canadian youth group to embarrass Canada severely at Copenhagen. And it's kind of made us realize, as we've done this more and more and more and more quickly, that really what we need is a structure to kind of enable organizations to do this rapidly with our help. And basically, it's quite simple. We're setting up what we're calling a Yes Lab, and there will be 2 or 3 day workshops, intensive workshops with leadership and others from organizations. We'll figure out whether they actually want to do the action or whether they want us to assemble a team to do the action, and then it'll happen and we'll kind of follow it, but we won't do it. It'll be about training, leadership building, and making projects happen that are strategic for activist organizations. So that we're launching now, pretty much. We've got 3 projects in the works that I don't think I can talk about. 2 of them we have no idea what they are yet, which is good. The idea is not to know what they're about until we start brainstorming. One of them we know exactly what it's about, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So, yeah. If you want more information, if you want to read an incredibly long document about this, you can go to the yesmen.org/lab, and it's a PDF, and you can learn way more than you want to know about it.
And we'll probably maybe see if Andy maybe can put out a sign-up sheet after the talk if anybody wants to be involved in future Yes Menery-ish activities.
In fact, yeah, can we pass around a piece of paper people can put their emails on? That would be great. Forgot about that.
And there's very little chance of, there's only been one Yes Men intervention that's resulted in a lawsuit out of many dozens. So there's very small chance that you two will be named in a lawsuit. Don't worry, it's no big deal. I guess, well, I wanted to, I know, Ken, that you had stuff to say, sort of, you know, riffing off the Turkmenistan story, and I think you wanted to talk a little bit about the response from your, you know, fellow journalists.
I can talk a little bit about the media response, and also I should say that my email address is ken@harpers.org, and I'm always sort of interested in tips or ideas, and periodically also research intern help as well. So I want to make sure to also throw that out. Well, I mean, the media reaction to the piece was pretty interesting. I mean, Howard Kurtz, as I mentioned, of The Post, did a lengthy piece, big picture of me and everything, talking about how horrible it was what I had done and how, as it, you know, as I had said, that you can never use deception and that undercover reporting is always wrong. And, you know, even as he deceived me about why he was calling me and how he was still had an open mind about everything. But, you know, the lobbying firms, and especially APCO, aggressively courted the media and tried to turn, with some success, thanks to Kurtz, into turning the story, it into a story about media ethics and not about, gee, should this lobbying firm be working for a Stalinist dictatorship. I mean, they wanted to change the subject. And they did have some success doing that. And there was a lot of, you know, debate about the piece, and some media critics and outlets sided with me about it, and others took sort of the Kurtz position. But, you know, as I knew that the piece would be criticized. I mean, in fact, I predicted to my editors before we wrote the piece that we would be trashed by Howard Kurtz. And it's like, I knew, that was like, okay, I mean, that was obvious, because he's like the sort of, you know, self-appointed guru of media ethics and all things media in Washington. I mean, to me, Kurtz is like the weather vane on the conventional wisdom. I mean, I hate that sort of journalism. It's like, you know, there's no such thing as good or bad. Truth lies in the middle. Well, sometimes that's not true. I mean, sometimes there is right and wrong in the world. But, you know, Kurtz's view is always that you have to have balance. This is this word that is destroying American journalism. Because, you know, when I worked at I worked at the LA Times, I'll try to keep this very quick, but to me this was, and I actually ended up writing about this and getting in, well, I wouldn't say I got into any real trouble about it, but I was still at the LA Times, and I sent a memo to Michael Massing of the New York Review about books about what had happened. I proposed a piece in 2006, I think it was, or 2004, to go to St. Louis before the elections. Because if some of you may remember, in 2000, of course, the real action or the decisive action was in Florida in terms of the presidential election, but St. Louis was a disaster. I mean, there were, you know, huge numbers of African-American voters in the city were prevented from voting. I mean, there's lines all over. I mean, when John Ashcroft's Justice Department says there's been a violation of civil rights against African-Americans, you know it's bad. So the city of St. Louis entered into a consent decree with the federal government to make sure that African-Americans were not prevented from voting in 2004. So I pitched a piece to my editors and said, hey, I'm hearing, I've contacted people. There are a lot of problems in St. Louis. And the Secretary of State in Missouri is a very right-wing Republican who happens to be on the Bush-Cheney reelection committee. And, you know, let's take a look at this situation. This is a, you know, this could be a very serious matter. And so they agreed to send me to St. Louis to do a piece on this. And I actually think I turned in a pretty good story. Where I did talk to both sides, but I said, hey, there are a lot of worrisome signs here. And, you know, Republicans are saying, oh, it's, you know, the Democrats are going to cheat, and there are all sorts, you know, that there are all these people fraudulently registering to vote with phony names like, you know, Willie Mays or Tiger Woods or whatever. You know, people are registering under phony names. Like, okay, first off, you know that there's not going to be enough fraud in that case. Actually, this was an Acorn story. They said that Acorn was registering all these people under phony names. This was a bogus story, a bogus Republican story that was reported throughout the 2004 campaign that, you know, Acorn and other groups were registering all these people fraudulently. There was, you were never going to, okay, so let's say you register as Tiger Woods. What happens? You're going to actually go to vote and have ID, and they're going to let you vote? I mean, this was not going to impact the election. And I even had the head of the Republican head of the Board of Elections in St. Louis say, that's sort of ridiculous. I mean, we're not seeing any cheating on the Democratic side. So I turn in a story about the potential problems in St. Louis in this critical swing state of Missouri, which turned out, I do have to admit, you know, Missouri went Republican by 5 or 6%, so it wasn't as close as it looked like it might be at one point. But I turn in a story, and, you know, I don't hear from my editor, which is always a bad sign, and then I'm told the next day that they've decided that we should do the piece from four states, from Missouri, but also from Florida and Wisconsin, and I can't remember the fourth state. So it was like two states where Republicans say there's going to be problems and two states where Democrats say there are going to be problems. And so you end up with this idiotic story that says the Republicans say Democrats are cheating and the Democrats say Republicans are cheating. So first off, who's going to read this story? I mean, you read the headline and you already know what you're going to read. And secondly, you're just saying, oh, you know, we're unable as reporters to evaluate what we see. We can report, but we can't use our brains and pass judgment. You know, this was a case where in Missouri, it was clear that the problems were all on one side. But they decided we had to balance this out with four states, you know, so that it looked like we weren't taking sides. And I actually, you know, I wrote a memo to my editor saying, you know, this is great. We've sent, you know, spent thousands and thousands of dollars and sent reporters to four different states to produce a story that says absolutely zero. I mean, what a waste of time and money. So, you know, to me, I'm digressing here, but, you know, the Kurtz view of the media is just that one should never have a point of view, you know. And to me, it's just sort of reflective of the general collapse of Washington journalism and the way that so many Washington reporters are so close to the people they're supposed to be covering that they're incapable of doing it in any honest, decent way. I mean, you know, you have reporters who, you know, they make the same amount of money as the lobbyists and politicians they cover. Their kids go to the same private schools. They vacation together in Martha's Vineyard. They spend time at the same bars. Mm-hmm. They're friends. And, you know, so it's very embarrassing to write something that might embarrass you at your next cocktail party. Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem with Washington journalism in general, in my view. And I think this is a self-serving interpretation, but I think part of the reaction to my piece was, how dare you? You know? Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of criticism of the piece from the mainstream.
There's a kind of small example.
From
our film of an example of a journalist just completely ignoring the story and writing the story that she wanted to write regardless of what she was seeing in front of her. And it's pretty dramatic and just, it maybe is the most interesting bit of investigative journalism in the film, although it's not highlighted as that. But it's we're impersonating the head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development in New Orleans a year after Katrina. And on the dais with me is Mayor Nagin of New Orleans and Governor Blanco of Louisiana. And afterwards, it's revealed to be a hoax. The media immediately figures it out. There's no question. I announce all these fantastic things, and a reporter gets me. And then another reporter starts interviewing me and says, pretends to believe that I actually am the deputy secretary of HUD and follows me around, and we go to a mock ribbon-cutting ceremony at public housing, which I've announced on the podium we're not going to destroy after all. HUD actually was going to destroy the public housing. I announced we're not going to destroy it. And her story, she's decided right at the beginning, is going to be, oh my God, they gave false hopes to the victims. This is really cruel. The people who were hoping to get back into their public housing are not going to be able to. And we go there, and she's interviewing me, and it, you know, in the process of the interview, she calls me out and says, actually, you're not, and so on. But one thing in the film, you see a resident of public housing. You see her asking a resident of public housing, what do you think of this hoax? This is not true. They've just concocted it. You're not getting into this public housing. And she says, and the resident says, quite clearly, I think it's fantastic. It's a hoax. So what? It's called people out here to see what we're going through, and that's what's important. So I don't care if it's a hoax. And she doesn't use that in the broadcast. So the broadcast is still about that party line, which is, you know, we created this false thing. It's, of course, it's the right thing to do to destroy it. You know, it doesn't call into question anything about what we had hoped to call into question.
If I can just real quickly say that the public reaction to my piece was overwhelmingly favorable. I mean, usually when I write a piece, I do get a fair, you know, you always have people 20%, 30%. Mostly they're on your side, of course, if they're readers of Harper's. But I get lots of critical emails. And on this, in this case, it was overwhelmingly favorable. And I got the best email. Unlike the general reaction in, amongst the Washington media, the public was just, you know, very enthusiastic. The best email I ever got in my life, I think, certainly ranking high, was from a woman who said to me, I loved your story, and if you die tomorrow, you should be happy. Like, you've done enough. It's like, thank you. That I felt good for a whole week after that email. So, I mean, there was no, you know, the general public didn't have this angst about, gee, what's worth, you know, deceit, going undercover into a lobbying firm or agreeing to represent a Stalinist dictatorship. This is a big moral dilemma for Howard Kurtz, but, you know, your neighbor does not think like that, so...